Yeah, I wanted to. I was at a retreat last fall, and over the course of the retreat, we went and we went through the four Brahma Viharas, and talked about it a lot, practiced them, and I got really interested in the idea of the near enemy, and wanted to talk about that tonight. I don't know if the talk will turn out that way, but that's what I wanted to. But first, before I start, how many people have heard of the Brahma Viharas? Okay, a couple. Good. Then I get to tell you about them. So the Brahma Viharas, it's a practice that's an allied practice to the one that we normally do here. Normally, we pay attention to whatever comes up. We just do it the courtesy of calling it by name, in, out, rising, falling, pain, hearing, thinking, whatever. An allied practice from the same tradition is the practice of loving kindness or compassion, joy for others, equanimity. And those are called the Brahma Viharas, and two parts of that. Brahma was he was a divine, in Buddhist cosmology, he was the god. He was a god. He was divine. He wasn't a creator. He wasn't didn't live forever. He thought he might, but he all things pass. But he was the king of the gods, or the top god, and basically spent his time having good thoughts about people, unalloyed with anything else that might seep in there for us mortals. So this kind of god was he wasn't an angry god or a righteous god. He didn't have rules for people. So it wasn't the kind of god that some of us grew up with. So there's this just this general idea of loving kindness or generosity and goodwill coming from him. And Vihara means actually abode. It's actually the same word for monastery. So the idea is that these are abodes, these are places, although they're mental states, they're ideas that they're not places just to visit, but places where we might try and actually live, get comfortable in, settle in. So these four mental states, which people, some people make this a major part of their practice, for others it's an occasional thing you throw in. The first one is called metta. And that's often translated as loving kindness. The word for metta is similar to other Pali words, meaning friend and gentle. So I think of it as gentle friendship, because sometimes loving kindness can have this kind of saccharine, sticky, sweet feeling to it. And I don't think that's what it's about. In fact, kind of my talk is going to be thoughts about what these, you know, different translations or different ways of looking at the words, not that these are right or the others are wrong, but just to turn things over and say, am I missing something here? Have I picked up something from my background or from the Western culture, and I'm applying that thought to these, I'm thinking, confusing that with something that the Buddha thought and thinking that it's just fine. And maybe you're cheating yourself. Maybe we're using the wrong words or the wrong thought, and it kind of fits the form, but it misses the function of the feeling. Then there's karuna, or compassion. Mudita, and sometimes it's called sympathetic joy. It comes from a Pali word meaning to be pleased or to have a sense of gladness. So this is joy for the happiness of others. And then there's upekkha, or equanimity, or perhaps just balance. That's the Pali meaning of the word, is balance. So together, these four feelings comprise basically our healthy relationships with other people. There's just a general feeling of goodwill towards people. Sometimes we practice that by phrases like, you can start with yourself, may I be free from danger, may I have mental happiness, may I have physical happiness, may I have ease of well-being. In this economy, maybe that means having a job. You know, that's, then there's karuna, and and that is good wishes for people that are actually in suffering. And you can say, well, may you be free from suffering. May your sorrow and pain pass, suffering pass from you. Mudita is a joy in the well-being of others, and equanimity is just being all right with whatever happens. You've done your best. You've wished people well. You've tried to relate to them in their pain. You've felt good about them in their successes, but in the end you realize that as much as you wish well for somebody, you can't make your choices for them, and you just have to have some balance about it. So they're typically cultivated just by sitting down and thinking these, repeating these thoughts over and over. And that's why it's different than the Vipassana that we normally talk about. But first, this isn't a test to see if you're a good person. I mean, this isn't a test to say, oh, may I be happy, or to think about somebody else, may you be happy, may you be healthy and strong, may you be safe from inner and outer harm, may you be free. Nothing's working. I must not be a very good guy, right? Well, it's not that. The reason we... This is practice. That's why we call it practice. We're doing things we're not yet good at. There's a guy I know is very much into the martial arts, and he hung out with this guy that taught hand-to-hand combat to the Navy SEALs. And this guy told my friend, he says, you know, when the chips are down, your performance doesn't rise to the level of your expectations. It falls to the level of your training. So I kind of think about that in a little less gruesome context is this. This is, you know, we're practicing things we're not good at yet so that we do get good at them. And when we need to, that tendency may be there. That intention is more familiar to us. It comes to mind more easily. So it starts off by sitting on your pillow and directing these thoughts to yourself, then to somebody who's a friend, then to a benefactor, somebody who's a difficult person, etc. But you're trying to actually get more comfortable, more familiar with the intention. And it may be something that you think you're failing at, and then when you least expect it, it pops up. You act toward yourself or to somebody else in a way that you wouldn't have before. You hear stories about people practicing metta and going to meet a difficult, and they pick a difficult person at work as one of the people they're relating to is practicing this intention. And then they're in a meeting with that person after the retreat, and the thing is that you? Is that really you? You related to me in a much different way. There's a phrase that comes to mind. As a Japanese monk said, "Today I'm dissatisfied with myself of yesterday." And I like the way he puts that, because it kind of is a balance point in there. He never said, "Hey, what's not to like?" He never said that. Or he never said, you know, "I don't like myself today, but I hope I will tomorrow." It was kind of like, "Today I'm dissatisfied with myself of yesterday." And so there's a sense of progression in there, of working on the little things, just looking, turning it over, turning the little things over, and trying to get better, being honest about each one, getting better day by day. And that's kind of my sense of what these practices, about our whole practice is like, but it comes up in this context here as well. I already mentioned that this is different from Vipassana, and that you can do these practices, dedicate your practice to just metta, or you may choose to start off one of your sittings with the first 10 or 15 minutes of metta toward yourself or towards somebody else. You can start with yourself, and that's probably going to be hard because we're so used to being hard on yourself. You can start with yourself. You can move to a benefactor, a good friend, somebody who's maybe not a family member, or certainly not of the of a sex that would be attractive to you, but somebody that's just where it's easy to have good feelings. Move on to a neutral person. Then you can move on to the difficult person, and that's where things kind of get interesting. And it's said that when you actually move on to thinking about the difficult people, that you can actually, your concentration can actually increase, and that your intention will actually flower. I wanted to return to how this is different from Vipassana, because what I've been talking about here is actually having a set of thoughts, and you go through them one after another and you repeat the same thing. And most likely when you've come to these classes before or heard Gil or somebody, the idea is don't get caught up in the storyline. You know, if the thoughts come, let them pass. Don't hang on to them. Don't direct them. That's true for Vipassana, which is one of the two main styles of meditation that we do, that the Buddha taught. One style was right mindfulness, and another style was right concentration. And this metta practice, all these, is one of the many styles of right concentration, or looking at mandalas, or colored discs. There are all kinds of things. So this is different. So please don't confuse the two. You can do them together. Just know which one you're. You can do them one after another. Just know which one you're doing. And one of the reasons that we can do these practices, it's not because of a kind of a do as I say morality. I like the way that the Buddha taught these things as having practical benefits. He knew the dangers of anger, and of the other. Anger, greed, and delusion. And he tried to steer people away from them, not because he had a set of rules and he was keeping score, but because he knew that the suffering that would come for people who lived in anger, hate, delusion, and greed. And he also had a very... he would also often lay out a series of benefits that people could get from participating in any particular kind of meditation. And the benefits include sleeping in comfort, waking up in comfort, having no evil dreams, and if you think about it, just having a good night's sleep is a real blessing. I've missed a few lately, and I know what it's like not to have them. And if you're staying awake because you've hurt somebody, or you're worrying about something you did in the past, that's just a drag in your quality of life. And that's the kind of thing that the Buddha, certainly not the only thing, but the kind of thing that the Buddha was mindful of. He said, you can avoid those kind of states by, for example, with any of these concentration practices with metta, while you're doing them, you're not entertaining anger, greed, delusion. And for that period of time, your life will just be that much better. He also said if you practice metta, you can die without you'll die without being confused. And that's a big one. I've been thinking about this. One of my best friends, we could go today, went into the hospital to get a. Angiogram, the catheterized to see if he was if he had heart blockage, and he came home today after a four-way bypass, and I like, whoa, what a week! Goes in for a treadmill test, they keep him overnight, do surgery on him 24 hours later, and now he's back, and that's a real. Real confrontation with mortality, and you get to think about, if I'm there with all these tubes coming out of me, and I'm afraid, I don't know what's going on. There's nurses and machines and lights and all of that. I know what it's like. I know how confused I get just sitting on my cushion sometimes. If these are my last moments, and I had a chance to face them, without confusion or fear, That would be something I'd want to work on. So I just, it just kind of came up for me this last week, that just slapped in the face. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about, so here's an analogy they give in one of the classic texts about these states. When abiding in the measureless states, which is another name for them, because there's no limit to metta or these others if you practice them fully. One abiding in the measureless state should practice loving kindness and the rest like a mother with four sons, namely a child, an invalid, one in the flush of youth, and one busy with his own affairs. For the mother wants the child to grow up, wants the invalid to get well, wants the one in the flush of youth to enjoy for long the benefits of youth, and is not at all bothered about the one who is busy with his own affairs. So I wanted to go over this thing a couple of times, take a couple of passes at various altitudes and tease some things out of it. I think they use a mother, and this is the kind of, I think this is the mother, the perfect mother that we, all think of. Maybe it's not the one we had, but it's the perfect prototypical mother. And this is the mother who doesn't have ill will, anger, or hate toward her child. And so when the person is thinking of the small baby, just wishing a good will, hey, welcome to the world. Anything you want, guy, I'm here for you. It's, no thoughts of, gee, this is the fourth kid. Ralph and I were going to stop at three. Why do we have four kids? There's none of that. There's just the pure metta, without the anger, the ill will, or the hate. And the compassion for the kid that's sick, that's unalloyed with cruelty or contempt or aversion. It's like, yeah, I know there's vomit and there's poop everywhere and the kid's crying. There's none of that. There's just, I want you to be better right now. Anything I can do to have your suffering and your sorrow pass, that's the spirit of compassion there. And the kid that's, growing up, he's the athlete, or she's the dancer, the singer, and the mother's just looking and saying, hey, that's great. There's no thought about, boy, I remember when I could do that. There's just, just go for it, just take it. That's the sense of, not a sense of comparison or something like that. There's this that being happy for somebody. And then there's the kid that, this goes off, they're graduated, got their degree, engaged, got a great job. In the suttas, in this teaching text here, they talk about the mother. I don't know any mother like this that just says, that's okay. I've done for you what I could. Welcomed you into the world. I changed your diapers. I taught you how to drive. But I can't make all your choices for you. So those are the... But there's no aversion in the sense of anxiety, doubt, or worry. So these things that we just talked about here in this first pass, these are called the far enemies. So for loving kindness, the far enemies are ill will, anger, and hate. For compassion, it's cruelty or contempt. For mudita, sympathetic joy, it's jealousy or envy, some form of greed or aversion. And for compassion, for a balance or equanimity, it's aversion in the sense of anxiety, doubt, or worry. So this, for some, sometimes this is as far as it goes, our understanding of these. Like, oh, I'm going to be loving and kind, and I'm not going to get involved in hating the person. And there's a lot of work and a lot of benefit to be gotten from there. If you can get over having a tense relationship with your boss because of the baggage you bring into the meeting, that's a real benefit. But there's another level here, and this is what let's see, I'm losing my place. Excuse me. Okay. There's a couple things to notice here. First, you may have found that it's easier to entertain some of these thoughts to different people, and that's kind of taken part of that's That's the normal course of events. All of us, when we start, some people are going to be easy, it's going to be easier to show loving kindness to some people than to others. It may be harder to start with ourselves, and we skip over ourselves and work on a benefactor or something. If we're trying to develop compassion, we probably won't want to start with a dear friend who's in hospital with bypass surgery, because that may be, you know, maybe we start with a neutral person. It may also be, you may also find out that it was easier to engage in some of the different Brahma Viharas, which I think is why they have this kind of graduated layout. You may have said, yeah, you know, I can in general, I can get behind the idea of having good feelings toward all people. But the idea of having compassion to somebody that's suffering, when maybe they, you know, I just don't relate to them. That's a little bit more foreign. Am I going to have compassion for Saddam Hussein? You know, maybe that's not really where you can, where you can get in and behind it. Mudita is even harder. Sometimes you say, yeah, you know, nobody really ought to suffer, but how am I going to feel good about this guy winning the governorship, whoever he happens to be, whichever one of the 125 people it is? How am I going to feel good about this person achieving their goal? And sometimes just true equanimity is just the hardest one. It's just the hardest one to get behind. So that's why the kind of metta is taken as a foundational practice. A lot of people, that's what they do. There's one Indian woman, actually she grew up in Burma, Deepa Ma, and that was her practice. She was just an amazing practitioner, but she practiced metta. She could walk through walls and teleport and all kinds of stuff like that. Most of us aren't going to get to that place, but that was her practice. It was metta. I know people that met her, and she was just an amazing person. And she just did metta, in addition to Vipassana too. But her concentration practice was metta. But the thing that got me excited about this was the concept of the near enemy, and that's where this. This kind of took off for me. The rest of this stuff was, yes, that's great. It's nice to know that I can feel, that I can work on feeling, deal with a difficult person and wish them well, and actually kind of get to a place where I can start to mean that and see that that could start to happen. But the idea of the near enemies was really what got to me. So if we revisit the example of the mother, so if the mother is really, you know, wishing well toward the child, and she may be avoiding the far enemy, which is anger, ill will, but maybe there's a little bit of proprietary interest in her well-wishing toward the child. Maybe, you know, the stage mother that has you know, make sure that her daughter is going to be the model, or take all the singing lessons, or something, to do the things that mom wanted to do, or whatever. Maybe there's a proprietary aspect in the goodwill. Maybe compassion, karuna, or compassion turns into pity. You know, oh, look at them over there. I feel so sorry for them. Thank God I'm not like them, and that they're over there. I feel so sorry for them. That's kind of not it either. The ancient teachers, they warned us against these things. Mudita. You can have joy over the happiness of others, but then maybe that turns into comparison. This is, I'm so glad he's got this, and I'm glad I got mine too. Or I'm really glad for him, but I wish I had a little bit more. Sometimes that aspect of it can get in there. Even though maybe we're not, you know, totally jealous or something, there's this other... The far enemies are kind of obviously the opposite of the Brahma Viharas. Obviously, hate is the opposite of loving kindness. Cruelty is the opposite of compassion. But the other one, the near enemies, are the ones that masquerade like the states that we're actually after. And sometimes they're more insidious because they can kind of convince you that they're the real thing. And if you're going just by the description, you may think that, oh, I'm really doing it here. I'm really compassionate, thinking about all those poor people over there. And what the teaching does is it kind of says, wait a second, are you distancing yourself? And does your compassion include distancing yourself from these people? Is that really where what this is all about for you? And upekkha is it really, this isn't being just stupid and unaware, is it? It's not being zoned out or saying, I don't care. Which it's can you really get to a point where you're truly equanimous, you're fully in touch with what's going on, but you can still be okay about it? It's not walling yourself off from the hurt or the anger or the anxiety. It's being fully present for it. In the sense of balance, I think of like a guy in a high wire, you know, the pole is balanced. I mean, he's not oblivious to anything. He's got to be right there for all of it, or he's going to fall to one side or another. And I think maybe that's... So I look at these things as kind of a whetstone for my practice. You know, I think, it's, okay, well, there's the voiding the far enemies. Well, that's kind of like the spiritually correct practice. You know, anybody can do that. Or it's you find the little books at the checkout counter in the bookstore, and you say, oh, isn't this nice? Oh, of course I believe in it. The Buddha must have said this too, right? But when you start, when you throw the near enemy in, and you start to say, well, what are my motivations? What is the purity of them? How am I really relating to these people? Am I selling myself a bill of goods here just so I can feel good about this stuff? Am I covering up the way that I really feel? Am I not facing something? Am I cutting myself off from this other person and telling myself a great story about how spiritual I am because I, you know, it's all okay? And maybe for each of us in various occasions it is, but then we're invited to look and ask ourselves if that's really the case. And that's why, I think it's the a whetstone for our practice. We can look at things and ask ourselves how we're really following our practice in any individual moment. And the last thing I wanted to say is a story I remember in terms of this moment-to-moment balance and checking in with things all the time. The founder of Aikido, which is a Japanese martial art, is a physical prodigy. He just did amazing things. And one of his students said to him one day, called him by his honorific title, he said, oh, sensei, he says, you're never off balance. It's kind of like, oh, you know, this is the state I want where I'm never off balance. You know, everything is, it's just baked in. It's all cool. And that's what he thought it was about. No sensei looked at him. He says, no. He says, I'm always off balance. I just catch myself earlier than you do. So that's kind of what I would, my roundabout way, that's what I wanted to say, is to recommend that you just kind of check in with yourself. Use this, whatever tools you get, if it's the near enemy or anything else, are you making things too easy on yourself? I mean, not in the way that you're going to beat yourself up, but in the way that you can be honest with yourself. Are there these tools out there? Are you taking advantage of the opportunity? Are you truly dissatisfied with yourself of yesterday, okay with where you are today, but dissatisfied with yourself of yesterday and maybe hoping to grow a little bit tomorrow? You know, we've got all these sayings and practices and tools, and it's good to get familiar with them, but being comfortable for no good reason is maybe more of a danger than a benefit. So that's what I wanted to say, and we've got time for comments and questions. We talk more as students than just because we don't have a chance to do that sometimes. Please.
Hi, I'm a new meditator.
Welcome.
I've done it before, but I haven't done it here. And I'm very easily distracted. And so when people come in late, I get this flash of irritation, and then I say to myself, well, why don't you think some thoughts of loving kindness? They're probably racing here from work. They're probably very stressed. They really need the meditation. You know, and it's a lot of work. And what I'd like is not to get irritated in the first place. You know, like I every single person that came in late, I had this flash of irritation, and I noticed it. And then I tried to change my thoughts. And what should I do with all that?
Okay. Well, there's... First, I should say that the floor was specially designed for this as a meditation aid.
It's working.
Yeah, it is. We paid extra for it. No, there's two things going on here, and you can pick either one. But I would suggest that you said when you come in, you notice that you're irritated, and then you try and think thoughts of loving kindness. That's you're doing Vipassana and then switching into Metta and then back out again. And if you do that, there's some danger. Although the Metta, I think that's great as a practice. If you were to do that and say, I'm going to do this and this is what I'm going to do, and you follow it. But if you interject a loving kindness in the middle of your meditation, it might kind of your Vipassana. It might encourage you into discursive thoughts.
Well, that's what happened. I sort of lost it.
Yeah. So it comes up, and although the thought, they're probably coming here, and they're late, and they're rushing, and I was just lucky that it didn't happen to me, that's a great thought, but it's still a discursive thought, and it's part of a story, an ongoing story. And in the Vipassana, if you just say, oh, I'm irritated, and then, now, that doesn't mean you're not going to get irritated at the next person. And that, you know, that's just...
Are you kidding me?
No.
That came a lot?
Maybe not in the course of an evening or a month. Anger, irritation, that's the last thing. There are like four stages, toward being an arhat. And the last one to go is anger. So... it's going to be around for a while. Noticing it, I think, gives us some choice about what to do about it.
So in the meditation, I should just say, oh, I'm irritated.
And then does that thought go? See if does a thought hang around? Without you saying, oh, please stay and let's practice, and let's go through the reasons why I'm irritated or whatever. No, right, don't indulge. You don't have to push it away either. Because if you're doing either, then you're not seeing the thought for what it is. You're not getting to know that thought. It might not be a comfortable thought. Believe me, we've all got uncomfortable thoughts inside, and if we're quiet long enough, we're going to see a lot of them. So just that's part of it. I think as you do more of it, you'll have... more comfort with it. You'll see that the thought maybe doesn't have the power over that you thought it did. But trying to change it, I wouldn't recommend that. I would recommend just noticing it and letting your relationship to it change by the fact that you're just seeing it for what it is without taking away or adding anything. Does that help? Okay. Not that it's easy. Not that it's easy. Was the idea of the near enemy, was that new to anybody? Or did it sound like, oh yeah, I've heard this, I just didn't know that that's what they called it in Buddhist teaching?
Yeah. An example of a near enemy and a far enemy?
Oh, okay. Thanks, Dick. Yeah, like for mudita, let's just go. I'll just go through them again. For metta, which is loving kindness, the far enemy is the opposite, right? The far enemy is hate or some form of aversion. The near enemy might be some kind of blanking on the word. You know, it might actually be some form of grasping, or instead of unconditional love, it may be conditional love. I mean, so I love you as long as you do your homework, or whatever. There may be some element of grasping or ownership involved, which is, it looks like love, which is such a big word, but it actually has all these other aspects in there that are distancing, the setting up a special relationship between us and the other person. And for compassion, a near enemy would be pity, which puts a difference, the distance between you and the other person. It's maybe a more socially acceptable distance than contempt or cruelty, but on the finer scale, it's still something we can work with in our practice. Sometimes those things show up, and for some people, that's their idea of what compassion is. It's, oh, these poor people, and there's still something there to be worked with. I'm not saying that it's easy, but there's still something to be worked with. Can you? I think that's a hard one. It's like, if you're concerned about the world, and it's hard not to be these days, how do you care about things enough to act, to vote, whatever, and then not get all latched up with the outcome? I mean, I work with that a lot. That's just like, how do you be politically active and be okay if you lose, or put all your effort into working against this cause, for this cause and against this cause, for this candidate against that candidate, and not set up in a relationship of aversion. I think that's I've seen people. I spent a fair amount of time in land use politics, environmentalism, what you're allowed to do with the land. Can you build a highway over this mountain or not? That kind of thing. And I ended up leaving after a while, finding something else to do, because I found that my fellow environmentalists were so full of hate. It was like, well, those developers, I'll get them. After a while, that got to be a real drag being around, you know. I'm glad they're not going to build a highway over this mountain, but after a while, politically acceptable hate is still hate. If you're going to work, it just comes up all the time, especially if you're trying to figure out how you stay involved in something that might keep you awake at night, but then still go to sleep without just saying forgetting about it. I don't know.
I think that's part of the problem, though, is being able to maintain your passion or compassion. What I find is that sometimes I feel that Buddhism is very inactive and very passive, because it's almost as though one of the things that drive you towards, say, a certain as an environmental.
Right.
And part of my ability to be actively involved in that is because I have a passion for it. On the other hand, when the butterflies are bulldozed, I think it's hard to maintain passion for things if you also have to say, okay, now I'm not going to hate them. So I find myself struggling with even maintaining a passion for things sometimes when I think too much about Karuna and Mudita. It gets harder.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to hear what Dick has to say about this too. I remember going to listening to one teacher who talked about anger. And he said, you know, it kind of gets a bad rap. He says, because, you know, we need anger to fight all this injustice. And I thought, how about that? But then, you know, I'm not sure, you know, if it's you know, passion's one thing, but anger's another. I'm not saying you were saying anything different, but you bring up the same point that I struggle with too. It's how do you care enough to do all the stuff you need to take on any one of the gazillion things that are tearing our world apart today, without being turned into what you don't want to be, what you're fighting against anyway. I mean, how do you turn into, you know, we've met the enemy and he is us, and you know how do you avoid that? And I think that's just being aware of it is the only thing I can recommend right now. It's I don't have it worked out. Dick, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been there. I would say about equanimity is it's important to maintain it, but it has to fit right between healthy passion, which is about recognizing that something's really important. It's an issue that makes a difference. And on the other side, the other near enemy is being overwhelmed or giving up, resignation, which is also something that's not good for the cause. it'll make the activist give up and become ineffective. That's a tool for the enemy, not for yourself. I remember the story that probably a lot of us have heard about Thich Nhat Hanh when he was a young monk during the Vietnam War. He was a monk in robes, and he was terribly torn between what the Americans were doing to his country and his Buddhist vows. And so one of the things that he said to himself at times was, well, I'll be a good Buddhist during the day, and I'll be a good warrior at night. And that's kind of tough. I don't know if you could do this for very long. Moment by moment, you can change, right? Well, maybe. I don't know. But I think that's why equanimity is so hard, is because it's got some very strong pushes on one side or the other. And it's hard to be in the middle. I think that's about all I can say.
Yeah. Dick's very active in Buddhist Peace Fellowship and I know that I think if anybody wanted to talk to him later about this, if this conversation speaks to you and you're looking to other people to deal with that are dealing with the issues actively, I think Dick would be a good resource. For future reference. Yeah. Anything else? I like the way the conversation, I think we had a good conversation here. Why don't we just sit for a few minutes about, with whatever you got from that conversation about not becoming the enemy or whatever feelings are in your body or churning through your thoughts churning through your mind, let's just sit with them for another few minutes.